Hey, it's the Plus One podcast from All Songs Considered, and I'm guest host and NPR music hip-hop reporter Rodney Carmichael. How long will they move me? Now, more than 20 years after he was gunned down on the Las Vegas Strip, we're still obsessed with the unsolved death, life, and musical legacy of Tupac Shakur. In the last 2 weeks alone, we've had famed New York radio DJ Funkmaster Flex taking to social media and tearfully blaming Pac's vengeful rhetoric during the time for the death of Biggie Smalls, whose murder also remains unsolved after two decades. In response, two more definitive artists of the era, Tretch and Spice One, both of whom were friends of Pac's, have also issued diss tracks going back at Flex. Meanwhile, in Hollywood, the USA Network has a new series on the murders of Biggie and Pac called Unsolved, which is coming this fall. And a new Tupac documentary is coming from Steve McQueen, the director of 12 Years a Slave. Now, unlike the highly anticipated Tupac biopic, All Eyes on Me, which finally hit screens June 16th, this new documentary has the backing of Tupac's estate. Now, as a longtime fan of Pac the artist, the iconoclast, the revolutionary, he's such a hip-hop deity that I think it's easy to forget how many people have actually risked their lives and even died trying to get to the bottom of his story. So, to help make sense of all of this never-ending swirl of cultural obsession, I called up a friend, an investigative reporter, and former LA Weekly music editor, Ben Westhoff. He spent about 5 years diving down the Tupac rabbit hole while researching for his book about the heyday of West Coast gangster rap, which is called Original Gangsters and is now out in paperback. Now, Ben started off our conversation by explaining why we're still so obsessed with Tupac's story and the legacy that he helped create.
Tupac is the rare musician whose influence goes well beyond music, even well beyond culture. He's sort of like a political prophet almost, in that people are so interested, not just in his songs, not in his just in his hits, but in the things he said, the things he believed. People buy books of his poetry. People watch every scrap of video they can find of him. And he's inspirational, and he still is. You know, Tupac's popularity rivals that of any rapper who's still alive. He still sells, you know, and is just as listened to as when he was alive. And I think that has to do with his messages, pure and simple. And when you talk about the Black Lives Matter movement that's really come up in recent years, that was something Tupac really anticipated in his music and in his interviews. He was asking these questions that sound so obvious today, but at the time were a little bit shocking. Like, basically, why is a black life not worth the same thing that a white life is? And people, even beyond that, though, he wasn't sort of blatantly political. He was someone who spoke from the heart, and he was unfiltered. He wasn't trying to be, you know, for the mass media. He wasn't trying to have a wide appeal. He wasn't trying to get rich. He was just trying to speak his heart. And I think ultimately that's what spoke to people. There were plenty of dope rappers, you know, people like Dr. Dre, you know, who were just sort of making this amazing music. And there were plenty of really political artists like Public Enemy who were saying these really important messages with a social conscience. But Tupac just sort of spoke from his heart, and I think that's why he appeals still.
There's a paragraph in your book where you talk about Pac's growing global legacy. Why do you think that he has translated so well, this charismatic figure, this prophetic figure? He transcends culture. Why do you feel like he's been able to do that?
I think he spoke to oppression, spoke on behalf of the oppressed. And there's certainly every country you go to, every shanty town, every sort of repressed minority, and even people who aren't repressed, they identify with this message, kind of speaking up for the little guy, essentially.
I imagine that you had to do a lot of obsessing. You spent 5 years, right, working on this book, Original Gangsters?
Yeah. Back when I was the LA Weekly music editor, I got the chance to interview all these people that were involved with the NWA and the Tupac story, including people like Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, Snoop Dogg, members of the Outlaws, who are Tupac's backing group. And I sort of started to put this narrative together that took me places I never could have anticipated, all over LA, all, you know, South LA, gangland, all the places that Tupac hung out, the Valley, Death Row Records. And this narrative that eventually emerged was of someone who wasn't just, like I said, a musical artist, but someone who was speaking to bigger things and building a movement. And what's so interesting about Tupac's story is that it all happened so fast, it all crumbled so fast, and people have been obsessing over him and his music for much longer now than he was actually alive.
Let's set the stage a little bit. What year did you become music editor at LA Weekly?
2011.
Okay. So 2011, you moved to LA because you weren't there previously, right?
That's right.
Okay. How quickly did you get into the mythology and the story of Tupac? Like, does it still loom heavily over LA's hip-hop scene?
Yeah, Tupac still looms large over LA's hip-hop scene. There's so many rappers who want to be Tupac or say they're the next Tupac, and it's just a cliche at this point. And everything from Tupac's style to the sort of image that he projected, it's still very much in the mix.
When did you realize, like, you might want to take a deeper dive and do a book on not only gangster rap, but diving into Tupac's history as well?
I think once I really got the opportunity to interview a lot of these legends, like I got to interview Ice-T, got to interview Ice Cube, and some of the smaller players, it all sort of leads to Tupac. It's all a narrative that starts in Eazy-E's garage, basically, and leads to Ruthless Records, Eazy-E's label, where Suge Knight got his start, basically as a bodyguard for the rapper DOC. And then Suge Knight starts Death Row with Dr. Dre, and then he and Dre kind of fall out, and Tupac is imported and sort of supplants Dre as the big star there. And it's so much happened, again, in such a brief period of time. Death Row became the biggest label in the world. People like Jimmy Iovine got on the map, and they were basically printing money, and Tupac's influence just grew greater and greater, and then it all sort of exploded. And the ripples, as we can tell, are still being felt today. You know, there was Tupac's murder, Biggie's murder. A lot of people thought hip-hop wouldn't survive.
What did the LA rap scene feel like at the time when you got there? Because for a long time, it felt like the West Coast was dealing with the aftermath of that fallout, and in a way that stifled new creativity.
I think so. During the aughts, it was a very slow period for LA hip-hop, and there weren't a lot of people making hits. The South was coming up, and there were people like Snoop was still continuing to be a star, and The Game was sort of an heir to Tupac's throne, some people might have thought. And they were going, but there wasn't really that feeling like there is now. And then starting with people like Kendrick Lamar and the TDE label and people like YG, the mojo has come back to LA hip-hop in such a huge way that now it feels like it's on top of the world creatively and commercially.
So were you a fan? Were you a huge fan of Pac and during his lifetime?
I have to admit that I was more of a Biggie fan at the time. And
uh-oh.
I was, Biggie, his rhymes were just so hard to deny. They just struck me as being so perfect. His, you know, everything about the way he delivered them, it was just appealed to me. And Tupac, it's less about the delivery. It's less about the perfection with Tupac. Like I said before, it's more about the feeling. It's more about the heart, the character. And these were things I was kind of slow to pick up on. And nowadays, if you ask me who is more important, who would I rather listen to, it's Tupac. But, you know, I was a little slow on that.
So how did your views change after he died?
everything was kind of muddled for a while, and I'm sure that's the case with a lot of people. You know, first of all, his murder was unsolved. There was all this posthumous music coming out, and some of it, the production was really weak, and it was hard to really assess Tupac's legacy. You know, there were really two Tupacs, and I think you alluded to this earlier. There's kind of the Me Against the World and earlier Tupac. And that's the Tupac that a lot of people want to remember best, is the one that with a social conscience, the one that was had songs like Dear Mama and Keep Your Head Up. And then there was the post-Death Row Tupac and stuff like the Machiavelli album, where he really comes out hard. He's more on this gangster tip. He's threatening people. And that is the Tupac that was kind of in everyone's ears right after his death. So I think that probably contributed to me not really appreciating him for what he was. But as the years have gone on, you've kind of been able to sift through the noise, at least I have, and sort of appreciate both Tupacs in their own ways, really. And the Death Row Tupac, there's a lot to be said for him, too. He was sort of at the height of his craft. He was really putting together a sort of unified sound. And the Pac from this era is hard to deny, but you certainly wouldn't say it was especially socially conscious.
Let's check out another song. I think this is an interesting one. Are You Still Down? Because he's posing questions to his fans. And this is a guy who always was kind of foreshadowing his death and in a lot of ways foreshadowing his musical resurrection and how he would be remembered after the fact. And then I want to talk to you a little bit more about a lot of these theories surrounding his death.
Now up in Adam's song, I was raised to be strong, and mama told me be a thug since the day I was born. I came up out the gutter, never changed my style. Got for real about my papers cause the game was wild, and the fame was about to try to change me. And what's strange is nobody knew my name for a day. Now the whole world's calling me a killer. Young homies stay strong. I wonder if they'll listen to a nigga when he gone. Are you still down? Raise him up. 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 Are you still down?
All right, that's Tupac asking the eternal question, are you still down? Which reminds me a lot of Kendrick Lamar's album To Pimp a Butterfly, and obviously Tupac plays a huge role in that. But considering all of the ongoing obsession with his unsolved murder, how many theories at this point would you estimate there are about how Tupac died and who was behind
about how Tupac died? I'd say there's a good half dozen that are within the realm of possibility. There's a lot more than that, but those ones are potentially plausible.
And it seems like they tend to fall into a few categories, right? Like either it implicates, you know, law enforcement and or FBI, or it implicates rival gang members in LA around that time, or it implicates artists and or labels who may or may not have, you know, been considered rivals by Tupac. Is that
yeah,
true?
That's definitely true.
Okay.
This is such a perplexing case, and it's really frustrating. You know, you can take someone who's a big Tupac fan and genuinely will not be able to sort through all this stuff. So basically, you know, right after Tupac was murdered, there was speculation that Suge Knight probably had something to do with it. So Suge Knight was driving the BMW that night in 1996 in Las Vegas when Tupac was killed, and one of the bullet fragments grazed Suge's head. So, you know, this idea that Suge set this up and he was in the car also and almost got killed himself, to me and to a lot of people, that didn't pass the smell test right from jump. But there was this idea that Suge was going to profit off of all this unreleased Tupac music, that he was worried Tupac was getting ready to jump to another label, and so he had him killed for this reason and that. You know, a little hard for me to believe, and a lot of other people feel the same way. Now, the theory that is proposed and has a lot of evidence in its behalf is from the former LAPD investigator, Greg Kading. And he worked on the Tupac case after the fact. He got started in the mid-2000s. And what his theory went on was the testimony of a guy called Keefe D. Now, Keefe D was a Southside Crip from Compton who was the uncle of a guy named Orlando Anderson. And that's who Keefe D implicated in the actual shooting. He said that they were in Las Vegas for the Mike Tyson fight, the same reason Tupac was there. They'd come from Compton. They didn't come with the intention of killing Tupac. But while they were there, Tupac attacked Orlando Anderson, the Southside Compton Crip. Now, this was caught on videotape at the MGM Grand Casino Hotel. And Orlando Anderson left the premises, and according to Keefe D, they all got together, got in the white Cadillac, came near the Las Vegas Strip where Tupac and Suge were headed out, and that's where Orlando Anderson pulled the trigger. Now, there's a lot of reason to be skeptical of this theory, too. Orlando Anderson is dead. He can't speak up. He's dead of an unrelated shooting. But during his life, Orlando Anderson denied this. And Keefe D himself had even denied this previously. At this point, when Detective Greg Kading was interviewing him, he was sort of bargaining for his freedom. He'd been pinched on a PCP bust, and so he had every incentive to talk. So, you know, it seems like the closer we get to knowing an answer for this, we still remain pretty far away.
For you as the author of this book, I'm really curious, like, you know, with so many facts, so much speculation and theory around his murder, how did you determine who you could trust enough to even spend time going down a particular path?
That's a long process. And as an investigative journalist, it's something that I've had to kind of develop. And it has a lot to do with developing sources, talking to people off the record, really getting to know someone's access. You know, why is someone saying what they're saying? What's their motivation? Do they really know what they're talking about? And throughout this process, I like you said, I really learned who I could trust. And there's a lot of theories in this case, but I felt like it was my job, if I was going to tell this story right, I had to help the reader out. I had to really break this down and separate the wheat from the chaff to figure out what was credible here. So that was the process. Now, almost everyone I talked to who really, really knows or has reason to know has said that it's Orlando Anderson. I'm not 100% sure it was him, and we'll never know because he's not alive. The driver of the car, who's also been implicated, he was called T. Brown. He's not alive anymore either. He was murdered in 2015. So sadly, I don't know that we'll ever really know.
So were you scared? And I'm asking this because when you look at people who were either around Tupac in those last years, if you look at people who have investigated this case or gone against official investigation and come up with their own theories, so many people have died around, you know, mysteriously. Were you ever worried that you might be putting your own life into jeopardy by digging too deep or asking too many questions or unpeeling too many layers that, you know, people didn't want revealed?
Yeah, there's always this sense of how deep do I really want to go? Am I overturning rocks that really shouldn't be turned over? But ultimately, my curiosity, my interest in serving the readers won out, and it's just sort of what I do as far as being an investigative reporter. So ultimately, I just followed the story where it went. And I think that people respect that, you know. I think a lot of animosity surrounding this is when people are talking out of school, when people are saying stuff that they don't have any basis to know is true. And what I prided myself on this book was really taking a sort of unbiased approach and not being hot-headed, not being judgmental, but just trying to really lay the facts out and called it as it really happened.
Well, let's listen to another song. This is one I think is, again, Tupac laying it on us, giving us something to think about. This is actually my favorite Tupac song. And it's funny because this song kind of speaks to how his legacy has endured over time and really grown after he died. The song, Who Do You Believe In, it first appeared on Chronic 2000. Okay, so this is nearly 4 years after Tupac's death, and, you know, we're still getting new music from him that, to me, is arguably better than anything we heard while he was alive. Who do you believe in?
Let us pray. Heavenly Father, hear a nigga down here before I go to sleep. Tell me, who do you believe in? Who do you believe in? Hey. I see mothers in black crying. Brothers in packs done, plus everybody's high. Too doped up to ask why. Watching our own downfall, witness the end. It's like we don't believe in God, cause we living in sin. I asked my homie on the block why he strapped, he laughed. Pointed his pistol as the cop car passed and blast. It's just another murder. Nobody mourns no more. My teardrops getting bigger, but can't figure what I'm crying for. Is it the miniature caskets, little babies? Victims of a strength from drug dealers gone crazy. Maybe it's just the drugs, visions of how the block was. Crack came and it was strange how it rocked us. Perhaps the underlying facts they hide explain genocide. It's when we ride on our own kind. What is it we all fear? Reflections in the mirror. We can't escape fate. The end is getting nearer. Who do you believe in? I put my faith in God, blessed and still breathing. And even though it's hard, that's who I believe in. Before I'm leaving, the mask and the grieving. Who do you believe in? Who do you believe in? I put my faith in God, blessed and still breathing. And even though it's hard, that's who I believe in. Before I'm leaving, the mask and the grieving. Who do you believe in? Close my eyes, cause all I see is terror. I hate the man in the mirror, cause his reflection makes the pain turn realer. Times of Armageddon, murdering mass amounts. In a society, we're only getting the cash counts. I started out as a beginner, into the criminal lifestyle, became a sinner. I make my money and vacate, evade prison. Went from the chosen one to outcast, unforgiven. And all the Hennessy and PKI. The pain I feel inside, you know, it's like I'm living just to die. Fall on my knees and beg for mercy, not knowing if I'm worthy. Living life thinking no man can hurt me. So I'm asking before I lay me down to sleep, before you judge me, look at all the shit you did to me. My misery, I rose up from the slums, made it out the flames in my search for fame. Will I change? And I'm asking, who do you believe in? I put my faith in God, blessed and still breathing. And even though it's hard, that's who I believe in. Before I'm leaving, the mask and the grieving. Who do you believe?
So, Ben, what was the most surprising thing that you unearthed surrounding Pac specifically in researching this book?
The most surprising thing I unearthed while researching Tupac was all this stuff that he did to reconcile gangs and drug dealers. So some people know that right before the L.A. riots in 1992 in Watts, there was a big gang treaty between the Crips and the Bloods. And some people also know that Tupac helped author this set of bullet points, this treaty about drug dealing that the gangs agreed to follow. So basically it was like, we're not going to get kids involved, pregnant ladies. We're going to have rules for drug dealing so we can sort of make sure innocent bystanders aren't harmed.
So let's as we kind of start wrapping it down, let's think about where we are now. We're about to see this new film, this new biopic coming out June 16th, All Eyes on Me, which is not, by the way, backed or supported by Tupac's estate. Why do you feel like his legacy and his reputation is not only so debated, but so protected by people who have an interest in telling his story the right way?
the first thing I might say is that, you know, just because it's not the official movie that's endorsed by the estate doesn't mean it's bad, right? Like, one of the criticisms of Straight Outta Compton, the movie, was that it was produced by Dr. Dre and Ice Cube and the widow of Eazy-E, and it really told their story as they wanted it told, just kind of airbrushed and left all the bad parts out. So I think that's a problem a lot of music biopics have, is that they're just very airbrushed. They just make everything seem like it was hunky-dory and make the person look cool. It doesn't have the sort of texture and reality. And, you know, we know Tupac was a complicated guy. So I don't know what this movie is going to be like, but if it portrays him as sort of the complicated figure that he is, I think that would be a benefit. Now, all of this was made a lot more complicated by the fact that Tupac's mother died last year, Afeni Shakur, and she was the guardian of his estate. She did an amazing job, actually, handling things in the years after his death, because the Tupac name only grew and grew, and I think it was her handling of the estate that, you know, made it so Tupac was the kind of person who was on people's dorm room walls, you know, while other people from the era might not be remembered. So Afeni's death, she was originally behind the early version of the film. She was supportive of it. It was supposed to be directed by John Singleton, who directed Boys in the Hood and Poetic Justice, which Tupac was in. And that seemed to make a lot of sense. They knew each other. But she gradually fell out of the mix even before her death. And the director of All Eyes on Me, the version that's going to come out, is called this guy Benny Boom, who's best known as a music video director. And she declined to take a producer credit on the film, even though she was entitled to one. So that sort of showed she probably wasn't totally thrilled with it. But the idea that this film could have such a big impact on how Tupac is remembered going forward, this could be the sort of defining thing about Tupac. And I think that's why everyone is so protective and concerned about it.
So how do you see this thing playing out, man? Are we going to be, is Tupac going to be this mythical figure whose stature will continue to grow throughout the millennium? You know, will he be like a Christ-like figure that we'll be worshiping in another 1,000 years?
Man, I would not be surprised at all if my grandkids were listening to Tupac, if he outlived us all by a long shot. He's someone whose influence and legacy just keeps growing. And, you know, you have your rock and roll stars from other eras like John Lennon or Bob Dylan, and their lives weren't, you know, one-tenth as interesting as Tupac's. And when you're developing this kind of aura, this sort of like idol status almost, it's the events of your lives that become the story of myth. And this is already happening with Tupac. That's why people are worried about this movie. And I think that in the next decades, it will only grow, the myth of Tupac and his sort of idol status. So I don't doubt it at all.
Well, Ben, I appreciate you, man. It's a good conversation.
Well, thank you, Rodney. I appreciate you, man.
All right, man. Take care.
Big Sight, New Hank.
And that's author Ben Westhoff. His book, Original Gangsters, about the rise of West Coast rap, is out now on paperback. For All Songs Considered, I'm Rodney Carmichael.
All eyes on me. All eyes on me. You know what? I bet you got it twisted, you don't know who to trust. So many player-hating niggas trying to sound like us. Say they ready for the front, but I don't think they know it. Straight to the depths of hell is where them cowards going. Well, all you steal, damn nigga, holler when you see me. And let these devils be sorry for the day they finally freed me. I got a caravan of niggas every time we ride. Hitting motherfuckers up when we pass by. Until I die, live the life of a boss player. Cause even when I'm high, fuck with me and get cross later. The future's in my eyes. Cause all I want is cash and things. A 500, Benz want my flashy brains. Bitches pursue me like a dream. Been known to disappear before your eyes. It's like a dope fiend. It seems my main thing was to be major paid. The game sharper than the motherfucking razor blade. Save money, bring bitches. Bitches bring lies. One nigga's getting jealous. And
homie for a second, but before